The Independent Mind in Pursuit of Truth was a talk presented by Elliot Grosso at the Gutenberg 2024 Education Conference titled The Independent Mind. Elliot Grosso is the Vice President of Gutenberg College and has been a tutor at Gutenberg since 2012. We hope you enjoy this presentation.
Please join me in thanking David Snyder for his outstanding emceeing this weekend. Well, it's a great pleasure to be here. Little known fact, the undershirt that I'm wearing was brought to me by a friend who came back from Ireland recently, and the words on the shirt read, in English translation, "We're all in the same boat." And if you look at the ceiling, what do you notice? What is similar about a boat and this building? It's a long, interesting voyage that we're on. And this ship is currently upside down. Hopefully metaphorical, we're heading right side up. So this is the last talk of the day. I guess I better be really scintillating or really relaxing. And I thank you so much for your patience in advance. I want to acknowledge just the outstanding talks that I've heard so far this weekend and the passion and insight that I have gleaned from this conference. Chris, I'm not sure if how far I can go on the independence-dependence question. I'm going to log a few ideas here, and hopefully they'll resonate with your own, but really appreciated your thought. I'm really fortunate. I teach at Gutenberg College. I get to see Chris and Charlie and Brian and Naomi and Trisha all the time, so I feel deeply blessed to be able to work with them. And Andrea, you had some wonderful things to say about just sort of the extent to which we can hand off a worldview at all to students and what it means to lay a banquet and have them invited to it and see what they can interact with it. So thank you for those insights. They were wonderful. And Davies, as the teacher administrator on the other side of K-12, I thank you for your work in this area. Because having taught at the University of Oregon for 15 years, I can tell you that students are lost at sea, and they're struggling, and they need help. So thank you for working hard to help them. And Amanda, I have never loved math more than hearing you talk about it. So I asked Amanda why we couldn't add one half and one third, and I think she thought I was being cheeky. But I love what she was saying so much that I felt totally comfortable to ask an 8-year-old question in a room full of adults. I was really hoping to hear. No, but she gave me an answer. She told me I was absent that day and that she would be speaking with my mother. Will be no surprise to my mother to have a teacher call her. But thank you for that. And thank you all so much for stimulating discussions, for being thoughtful listeners, readers, and respondents to some really complicated issues. I mean, we're in a really strange historical moment in which we're grappling with not just the age of propaganda, but the age of efficiency. Efficiency has become our primary virtue in this culture, and we have mechanisms to arrive at it ever and ever and ever faster in a way that I think is tremendously problematic, because we don't seem to be getting any more efficient. And if we're made for the sorts of things that God says we're made for, which is to love our neighbor as ourselves, I find that to be a desperately inefficient endeavor. So if the thing that we're designed for is being placed in a cultural moment that's tearing at the fabric of what it is that we are, I think we face tremendous tension and complexity in a way that I really think previous ages have not experienced. I really think that 16th century Italy was not the age of efficiency. Age of things, other things, but certainly not that. And so, as one educator to many other fine educators, I would invite you to join me for the next hour to think about what it means to assist our students, to help them think clearly, cleanly, and responsibly about what it is that they are and what it is that they are here to do. We are not here for a very long time. Is very, very temporary. And so, given the fact that this is temporary, how do we make good use of the time that we have with our children, with our students, with our colleagues, with our communities? This seems to me a very important and it's a pressing question for me, at least. So the thing that got me thinking about the Pharisees and Jesus was this question. Did Jesus love the Pharisees? He speaks about loving your enemy and loving your neighbor. He recalls one of the Gospels, "You have heard it said, eye for eye and tooth for tooth, but I say unto you, love your enemies." And I'm thinking, well, to love my neighbor, an enemy is just a species of neighbor. So what do I do with that? What does it mean to love? If that's the thing upon which all the prophets and the laws hang, loving my neighbor as myself, an enemy is a species of love, what do I do with that? That's actually my complete, total, existential, broad calling, is to figure out how to do that. And I think that is incredibly difficult. I think it is incredibly difficult because love can be incredibly painful, because it is incredibly costly. It requires complete, total existential commitment of self for another for their ultimate good. So thank you for joining me in this inquiry together about how to think about this. So this lecture has three parts. We can ask, what is independence of mind? What does it look like? And what does it mean for education? And first and foremost, we want to look at what is truth, what does it mean to live a good life, and what is love? So I'm going to think here about truth as being reality according to God's perspective. I was asked recently if I believed in absolute truth, and I'm generally a kind of person who says, yeah, of course I believe in absolute truth. Of course there are things that are true that transcend my capacity to think about them and experience them. But then I started thinking more about the nature of knowledge, and it seems to me that knowledge requires some kind of knower, that God is the ultimate knower. So when I say that truth is this thing, I think what I am saying is that truth is God's perspective on all things, and that there must be a God in the equation of talking about something like absolute truth, otherwise something like absolute truth doesn't really make any sense. I'm limited by my perspectivalism. I've literally never seen the back of my head. That seems to be still here. I can feel it, so I guess I trust that it's there. And tell me, is it? You see it? How's it look? Is it looking all right? So this, of course, is not the only meaning of the word truth in the title, The Pursuit of Truth, because Jesus is the truth. He says that he is the way, the truth, and the life, and that no one gets to the Father except through him. So I think both ways of thinking about the concept of truth will be applicable here. So when it comes to our students, you know, we're asking them to live a good life, and we're talking about critically important things like righteousness and virtue. But broadly speaking, it seems to me that to live a good life, I must interpret reality according to God's perspective. Now, that's a tall order, because I'm not God. And God has a level of perspective and total clarity that I'm not going to achieve. My limitations are severe and significant. I can only know a little bit and only for a really short period of time. And the sorts of things that I know are incredibly limited. There are invisible things that are real. Electrons. That I've never seen. They're there, right? Please tell me they're there. Okay, thanks. Okay, good. So things of that sort. So what is God's perspective like? How do we help students think about it? Because there's a breakdown there. I'm not going to see everything the way God is going to see things because of my limitations. So I have to ask, well, what sorts of things does God want me to know? Not everything, because I'm limited. I can't know everything. I'm not going to know everything. So what sorts of things can I know? Well, one thing is love. Let's begin to understand what that is. He talks a lot about that. Jesus does in the New Testament. And so when it comes to independence of mind, and Chris gave this part of my talk for me more beautifully than I'm going to do it, but just to refresh, independence doesn't mean autonomy. It doesn't mean a plastic concept of self that's self-constructing on its own. It's not a form of individualism in which I somehow imagine myself to be completely alien and independent of social civilization, and then I enter into it voluntarily like some 18th century social contract theorist would argue. And it's not nihilism. Nihilism meaning the annihilation, the nothingizing of tradition and family and any form of God instituted government in the form of monarchy, democracy, whatever, what have you. So it seems to me that the reason I need to be independent of mine is so that I have the freedom to love. And that might seem strange, but if I'm bounded in the way that the Davies was talking about interacting with that gentleman in your dorm room the other night, if my commitments and loyalties are to the wrong things with the wrong intensity, it actually hampers my capacity to do what I'm designed to do. Because suddenly I'm serving what boil down to my material or social survival needs above pursuing the ultimate good of another human being, my neighbor, my enemy. So I don't know how successful I'm fully going to be at that. I'm probably going to do a lot of failing. I've done a lot of failing at that. But just to have that contrast in mind, that if my loyalties are wrongly assigned and got the wrong intensity, that's really not going to help me do what I'm here to be doing for the short period of time that I'm supposed to be doing it. And so it behooves us, of course, to think about what love actually is. I'm sure you've already read this. It's not feelings. It's not passive. Jesus says things like, "They will know that you are my disciples by how you love one another. There is no greater love than to pour out your life for one's friend." These aren't feelings. They're not passions. They're not passing fancies. They're very clear existential decisions to sacrifice myself for the ultimate good of someone else. And you can tell, we can tell, when someone loves us. Think of three people right now in your head who you are very sure love you. And think of three other people who you are sure that you love. That you love. Right? It's not, "Well, I kind of love them. I'm not really sure." Right? It takes too much energy. It's too inefficient. So much is leaving you to love another human being, and so much is impacting you to be loved by them. You couldn't possibly be mistaken about whether you're loved by them or not. If you're not sure, the answer is no, you don't love them, or no, they don't love you. Though I do get confused at the DMV sometimes. So, we're talking about an existential decision here. So our culture has really different perspectives on this stuff. Love is coming in and out. It's sort of how I feel at the time, and it's totally plastic and wishy-washy. This is love. Independence is I'm a totally individuated, unattached, uprooted individual, and that's to my benefit because I have to self-style, right? Which is unfortunate because it overlooks all the determinative variables in our lives that shape what it is that we become, variables and contexts into which God purposively installs us as selves. So there's one more piece to this question, and I think part of the question of being independent of mind has to do with how we think of what it means to be a self. So it seems to me that a lot of our culture tends to create faceless aggregates. This population, that location, this race, etc. I'm not sure how much God is interested in those kinds of categories. I'm not really sure if he buys into them. Because it seems to me that my moral accountability before God is assigned on a personal basis. Right? So no one can do my doing but me. No one can do my believing but me. No one can do my talking for me. And it's on this basis of personal responsibility that God is saying, "You, Elliot, 1L, 1T, you're the one I'm talking about, not white men over 35. So that's really different as well. And there's a sense in which our volitional, individuated personhood is essential for our moral responsibility before God. It's fundamental. And I think the thing that comes about when dealing with students is, as students are coming to realize what it is and who it is that they are, and receiving various kinds of influences from family and community and teachers, hopefully all positive, it seems to me that there can be that confusion about who I am and what I am. Am I this like uprooted, individuated self that has to figure stuff out, or am I just part of an aggregate, or what? So I think all these pieces kind of have to, at least in my mind, they integrate to help us think about what it really means to be independent of mind. Okay, so what does it look like to be independent of mind? What if culture and truth disagree? And we want to look at two theories of what it means to say that something is true. So, having studied music and culture for many, many years, Chris, I agree with you. I do not think there is a way to become fully disenculturated. Not only is it not realistic to attempt it, but I don't think it's even desirable. Because to be in a self means to be in relation to other selves. It means to be in relation to other things. And so what kind of role does culture play in this? And so I guess when I'm thinking about the departure between culture and truth or reality, I'm thinking mostly about ideas and thoughts and behaviors in a way that this is where the point of departure takes place. So I want to look at one particular example. And this is the tension, I'm going to call it the conflict, between Jesus and the Pharisees, which struck me yesterday, this is actually a conflict between educators. Jesus is teaching X, and the Pharisees are teaching Y. And what's interesting is that what they're teaching is interpretation. The Pharisees are coming along and they're saying, you need to interpret reality this way. We say, eye for eye, tooth for tooth. Jesus says, I think that's the wrong interpretation. I think your interpretation should be upgraded to my interpretation, which is to love your enemy and to forgive. So they're not agreeing about that. That's a huge problem. The biggest point of disagreement, of course, is how they interpret the concept of Messiah and what it is that they're expecting. So Pharisaical culture emerged around 150 BC during the Second Temple period, and they were particularly strict about Levitical laws and also the oral tradition that was passed down by the rabbis. And so they believe in the resurrection of the body. They believe in the Messiah. So the Pharisees, along with the Sadducees, are together in the Levant in this thing called the Sanhedrin, which is a collection of Jewish officials. And there are many kinds of Judaisms. There are many beliefs about resurrection or non-resurrection, Messiah, non-Messiah. But their picture of Messiah, the Pharisees' picture of Messiah, is quite interesting. What they are doing is they're looking back over their history, and they're looking at the kings, the anointed ones of Israel, and they are saying, the kinds of king that we are looking for is a powerful, charismatic military leader who is going to take us out from under the boot heel of Rome that has been grinding us down for many, many centuries. So they're looking at your Davids. They're looking at your Solomons. What's interesting about Jesus' interpretation of all of Scripture is that he had a particular clarity and salience that was astonishing to people. Even as a child, the Gospels talk about him going into the temple and teaching, and all the leaders are amazed at the way he connects the dots, the way he interprets what's going on, presents a fuller, clearer picture than they've ever heard. So his level of skill there, an artfulness that they don't have. One of the pieces that the Pharisees are arguably missing is that a lot of the way they conceptualize this thing called Messiah functions actually more like a curse than a blessing. I mean, if you think about the first human kings of Israel, Saul in particular, I mean, what are they doing when it comes to religion and politics? The Israelites, they're not looking up, they're looking around. And they're saying, oh yeah, look, they don't seem to be starving over there. We need one of those gods. One of those crop-growing gods that they have over there. Maybe we need a golden calf, or what do you say we get a king? A human king would be great. You know, we wouldn't get picked on. We wouldn't get enslaved anymore. We'd get destroyed in battle. They already live under a monarchy. God is their king. Yahweh is their king. But they don't want that. So they say to God, hey, you know, man, you're great and all, but how about a slice of humanity down here to rule over us like our super awesome, successful neighbors? And God's like, okay, sure. No natural consequences here. Just so you know, here's what's going to happen to you. He's going to take all your stuff and treat you like garbage and be really human to you. But, you know, just so you know, heads up. And so God sends Saul, and that's what Saul does. He's a disaster. And the Israelites will account for that. And so as the Pharisees are waiting for a Messiah, they've completely ignored this aspect of Messiahship, as it were. And so when Jesus says something like, hey, I think you're interpreting this stuff wrong. You keep talking about externals. God wants your heart. He wants you to want him. He wants you to be glad to obey him because he loves you. He wants you to participate with him in his work and be good servants and cultivators and stewards. They're going for the external. They don't want to hear this from him. Culturally, Jesus is a nobody. He's a carpenter from the backwoods of nowhere. So yeah, he's got some interpretive chops, but we're kind of important. So I don't know about that. We have these sorts of disagreements, which are incredibly complex. And so push comes to shove, as you've read, and they have many exchanges about murder, poverty, adultery, what to do on the Sabbath, what's allowed, what's not allowed. And Jesus says to them, and do not presume to say to yourselves, we have Abraham as our father, for I tell you, God is able from these stones to raise up children for Abraham. That's like the ultimate slap in the face. Think about what that means. What they are banking on is the fact that they are genetically related to Abraham. They're not thinking about genetics, of course, but they are the sons of the sons of the sons of Abraham. They are God's chosen people. They belong to God. They're the ones who God installed to carry out his kingdom and will on earth and to minister and lead God's people. And Jesus is saying, if you're not on board with me, God doesn't need you. God's not interested in your performance, your outwardness, your superficiality, your pride. He tells them they're dead inside, whitewashed tombs. Their interior rottenness, their putrid approach to handling people who are suffering and struggling, Jesus is pointing this out. And to say, this would be a better son of Abraham than you guys, that's a real hard hit. That's a real bold statement, really bold. And they do not take it well. They take it really badly. Okay. So, not all the Pharisees are the same. There's one exception. The exception is a man named Nicodemus. Nicodemus is among the Pharisaical class, and he is presumably, in some of these exchanges where they rebuke Jesus for how he's thinking and talking and teaching and interpreting things, but he goes in the night to talk to Jesus. So this is chapter 3. I'll read just a little bit. This is verse 1. Now there was a man of the Pharisees named Nicodemus, a ruler of the Jews. This man came to Jesus by night and said to him, Rabbi, we know that you are a teacher come from God, for no one can do these signs that you do unless God is with him. Then Jesus gives this utterly cryptic response. Jesus answered him, truly, truly, I say to you, unless one is born again, he cannot see the kingdom of God. Nicodemus says, How can a man be born when he is old? Can he enter a second time into his mother's womb and be born? Which is kind of an interesting response. He's taking Jesus at a superficial, literal kind of level. He thinks Jesus is saying, yes, you actually, yep, got to be born again, literally. Second labor, all that. He's not really reading Jesus very well. He's not interpreting him very well. And so it's almost like Jesus is saying here, like, you got to start over. The kind of mental rerouting that you have to do to get on board with this program, it's like being born again. You would have to know nothing and then build from the beginning to be on board with this. So Nicodemus is not reading this. What's interesting is that Nicodemus is there to figure out the truth. He's surely talking with his colleagues. You know, they're probably complaining about Jesus and the Romans are, you know, coming for us and all these problems. And Nicodemus is hearing this. He's a very intelligent guy. But he sneaks away at night to figure out, like, what's actually the truth here? Like, if I get a one-on-one in private, what is this Jesus of Nazareth actually going to say to me? What do I do with this? And so what's happening here in these conversations, it seems to me, one thing is that Nicodemus has a framework for interpreting something like Messiah, but he's got questions about it. He's starting to flex about it. He's not totally certain that he's got it right, so he's trying to figure out the truth. He's trying to figure out, what are you exactly? And so they have a long conversation, and we don't hear a ton more about Nicodemus in John's gospel, except at the end, where we hear that after Jesus is deposed from the cross, Nicodemus and Joseph of Arimathea show up. Nicodemus brings 75 pounds, very expensive, of spices to anoint the body of Jesus. Now, John doesn't exactly say what that means, but John doesn't mention any other Pharisees. And it seems strange that a ruler of the Jews would show up to honor the body of a heretic and a blasphemer. Even though John isn't direct, very likely, it seems to me, that over the course of time, somehow, some way, Nicodemus came to think differently about the Messiah and who Jesus was, and conclude that Jesus was the Messiah. Now, this response from the Pharisees, I think, is really fascinating. So, why did they want to kill him? Right? They know sinners. They know heretics. They know blasphemers. Like, it's a culture of humans who they rule over. So why do they want to kill this one? This is chilling. If we let him, Jesus, go on like this, everyone will believe in him. And the Romans will come and take away both our place and our nation. That's what's most important to them, their place and their nation. In this temporary span of time that we've been assigned to, this is what matters to them. This world and the stuff of it and their power and prestige within it. So when Jesus comes to say, you know, I'm here to help you with your sin, they aren't interested. It's not because they think they're not sinners, though it's possible that they did think that. There's too much at stake to follow the truth. There's too much at stake to question their assumptions. There's too much at stake to ask a better question or review their assumptions. They love the world. He tells them their father is the devil, which is not good for them, unfortunately. Okay. So what's happening here is we're seeing a divergence between the truth and the culture. Most of the Pharisees are doing the cultural thing. They're doing what their oral tradition tells them. Nicodemus isn't. There's no record of Nicodemus, you know, throwing in the towel and saying, I'm not going to be a Pharisee anymore, or making public statements or revising his theology or publishing reviews or revisions of whatever statements were made about Jesus of Nazareth. But his mind certainly changes, and there's a divergence there. And there's an extent to which Nicodemus's perhaps a little bit like the centurion, where the centurion says, you know, now I'm a believer, what should I do? It's like, go back to doing what you're called to do as well as you can, given what you are and your limitations. So, Jesus says, I'm the Messiah. He says it's true. Pharisees say, you're not the Messiah. They think that's true. What does it mean to say something is true? And for that, we want to look at two theories of truth. First is called the coherence theory of truth. The second is called the correspondence theory of truth. Okay? Let's look at the coherence theory first. Imagine one night where you are listening to all these recordings again. You pull out your 5,000-piece jigsaw puzzle of the world, and you start to assemble it on the floor. Okay? You're picking up all the pieces. They're only one of four colors, unfortunately. You're trying really hard to judge, you know, what's the edge piece and where's the edge of the earth and trying to fit them together. You're making a lot of decisions. You're making a lot of judgments about what you're looking at, right? And slowly but surely, you begin to assemble a jigsaw puzzle. It takes a long time, right? Your decisions about this are hard won. And hey, starts to look like the picture on the box even. So you got some confirmation. Yeah, this is exactly right. What's interesting about this is that no one, having finished such a puzzle, would look at it and say, this is the whole world. Got the whole picture right here. Everything is there. Everyone's accounted for. Right? No one thinks that. What's interesting about the coherence theory of truth is that the main criterion, the rule by which you decide something is true, is that all the pieces fit together very neatly. They're all accounted for. There's no space in between. There's no mysterious room for error, right? You get 5,000 pieces, put them all together. This is the picture. And yet this picture does not translate onto the real world. Just a model, right? There's a lot of things missing. There's no flora and fauna. You can't feel the cold of the Arctic or the sweltering heat of the Sahara. Your loved ones aren't there. It's flat. There's a lot of problems, a lot of drawbacks to thinking that this is actually the world. The tricky part is that the coherence theory of truth is incredibly attractive because that which we believe we can know totally, we also believe that we can control. If my picture of reality is free from gaps and mysteries and unknowns and unexplainables and stuff like that, the likelihood of my believing that I can control it to my benefit rises quite significantly. And I think that is the greatest flaw and drawback of materialism. That the entire world is matter. It's completely and totally thoroughly knowable. All we have to do is aggregate enough observations and data, and we'll have this. Except we won't if there are things that don't fit in the puzzle, or if there are real unknowns that can't be accounted for by man. And so the confrontation of the correspondence theory to all of us, I have to face into the fact that I'm limited. And that billions and billions and billions of limited people put together are still limited. It is not actually possible to have the kind of comprehensive knowledge that I would like to control reality in the way that I would like to. But you can see how control would make this approach incredibly attractive. Right? If you're afraid of suffering and deny your mortality and think somehow you can live forever in this plane, yeah, you're going to work real hard on that picture. You're going to put that together fast. You're going to lose all kinds of efficiencies and propagandas to make sure that it all works together. The only problem is this picture doesn't correspond to reality. So yeah, anyone can paint a big, impressive picture. Question is, does it correspond to reality? In the coherence theory, all pieces must fit together neatly and answer all questions. By contrast, the correspondence theory of truth, the pieces must map on your reality. And so part of what we're seeing in the Nicodemus-Jesus-Pharisees interaction is the Pharisees have an incredibly coherent picture, right? Why would you ask questions for which there are already really clear answers? On what grounds would you doubt the world and its answers? Why would you do that? We have an answer to this one. We have an answer to that one. The world is full of fast and easy answers. And if you don't like the first 85 that you get propagandized with, you could pick the next 85 and sort through for an interesting one that corresponds to what you want it to be, right? I mean, that's part of what hate is talking about, is sort of the correspondence issue with something like confirmation bias. He talks about elsewhere. I don't think he did in the reading that we did. So I'm not here to necessarily poo-poo the coherence theory because, I mean, how are we creating a picture of the world? We're creating it 1 second at a time, where we're taking our limited sense experience and pieces of interactions, and we're trying to put it together into a whole thing. I think it's right and good that humans are designed to make something coherent, for the world to hang together in a sensible way. That's not a bad thing. I think that's what we're made to be doing. The question is, do we ask more of the process than it's actually capable of delivering? I think that's where things get really complex. So the Pharisees think, well, Messiah's got to look like this. I mean, you know, I've been saying this for hundreds of years, and he doesn't look like a carpenter from Nazareth. Therefore, doesn't fit. The piece doesn't fit. Fortunate that they're wrong, but you can see the logic. You can see how they put it together, how they're trying to think about it, outside of the whole they'll take our place in nation bit. It is tricky. The correspondence theory of truth is way harder to deal with. One, because we're limited, and two, because our experiences of reality are discontinuous, right? We go to sleep a quarter of the day. We don't know what's happening in that quarter of the day. We have no clue, right? So it's difficult to lean into a theory of truth, which on the plus side has a great deal more reliable truthiness than the correspondence theory, because it actually maps onto reality. The downside is I have to accept the possibility that there are going to be all these mysteries. There are going to be all these unknowns, all these empty spaces, all these unaccounted for things. And that can be strugglesome for us, right? We see a loved one suffering or a community suffering. We want to fix it. We want to help. We want to use the mechanisms we have to fill that need. So it's not surprising that so much of the scientific project has been aimed at the noble effort of eliminating suffering. And that's the project of science from the 18th century onward, to eliminate suffering. I don't think it's possible to eliminate suffering, nor is it beneficial. But you can see how that, do you see how that would make sense? How that would be a reasonable way to think about it? I'm not saying it's the right way to think about it, or the way I think about it, rather, but does that make sense? How someone would be drawn into that? So correspondence theory is a lot messier, but it's a lot more accurate. I think the other tricky part with the correspondence theory of truth is that we have to be okay with considering the possibility that God can make known to us the things that are essential for us to be knowing, like who we are and where we're from and who made us and who we're accountable to and what goodness is and all those sorts of things. He gives us this essential information. So it's not like chaos magically poofed into order and there's a distant God who doesn't care and we're supposed to figure it out all on our own. That's not the case at all from a biblical worldview. So we've got these really big pieces, but sometimes figuring out how they fit together can be challenging. At least I find them challenging. Okay. So what does all this mean for education? And so one of the things that I do at Gutenberg College is I teach microexegesis, which is close reading of difficult texts. It's basically the skill of interpretation. What we do is we hand around copies of Aristotle, English on one side, Greek on the other, And students read one sentence at a time and try to talk about what it is that they mean. The tricky part with interpretation is that it is a skill, it is an art, it is an ongoing process. And the more we practice, if we practice well, the better we get. If we're practicing well. But when we talk about what art is and how it fits with a worldview and how we might practice. So if the point of living, or to live a good life, I must interpret reality according to God's perspective, I must consider that interpretation is an art, and art requires practice. Art's not a mechanism. It's not a machine where there's a totally clear, complete, articulable set of parts that always fire in the right order at the right time. You don't want it to be that, because the stuff you have to feed, the stuff you would have to feed into such a machine would eventually be broken by all the variety. Right? You ask a question about how to love your neighbor, think about the variety in your neighbor. It's not a one-size-fits-all kind of answer. There are definitely patterns, don't get me wrong. There are definitely principles. But to say, the loving thing is to say this script to everybody I meet, no matter who they are or where they are or our relationship, right? No one would ever consider that. That wouldn't make any sense. Right? So part of it has to deal with having patterns that are flexible, that we can think about, review, and see, like, does this fit right here or does it not? So in my thinking, art is the observation, generation, or manipulation of meaningful patterns in a skillful way. This process-oriented. And an artist is someone who practices art. This is the purpose of the liberal arts, to produce artists, people who can do that. And the reason I was so delighted with Amanda's talk was I was seeing meaningful patterns because she was teaching me the skill of seeing them. That was incredibly mind-blowing and delightful for me because I had been taught math like I was a machine. Like it was just a matter of dumping data into me and the gears of my soul would just spit out the right answers. Don't even know why the right answers even mattered, given the way it was administered to me. I mean, this is really important. I think we minimize art in society because we love the certainty, we love the mechanism. Right? In Charlie's talk, he was talking about how the mind of the scientist is eliminated in the so-called method, which doesn't do anything near like what it thinks it does. But what do you lose? You lose skillful observation. You miss the pieces coming together. The picture erodes. It becomes a pile of sand in a sandbox. It's not intelligible, right? And we're intelligible, intelligent beings. We need things to be intelligible. We look for intelligibility. We're looking for the pattern. That's what it means to be a knower, is to look for patterns. So by contrast, if you're not doing artistry, you're doing something else. You're using techniques, which are mechanisms designed to achieve desired results with maximum efficiency. It's more outcome-oriented. And a technician is a person who uses techniques, not an x-ray tech, not a plumber. That's not who I'm talking about at all. And so, to give you an example, imagine two bakers. Working from the very same apple pie recipe. And one day, the first baker gets a call on the phone. Hey, this apple pie is really salty. Like, we couldn't eat it. $18 for a salty pie? I'm bringing this back. Baker one takes the pie back, tastes the pie, and she's like, you know what? You're right. Food is for eating, and this isn't edible. So should you keep using the same recipe? No, she has to manipulate the pattern. The recipe is the pattern. And when she manipulates a pattern in accordance with the telos of food, it does what it's supposed to do. And people are delighted. Her business booms. Baker number two, same recipe, same pattern, gets a call. Yeah, this pie is too salty, man. I don't know what to do about this. Yeah, you know what? I followed the recipe. See you later. It's fine. I'm sure it's fine. You know, they look the same. Golden crust, beautiful lattice work, glistening filling. I used apples. I don't even use those crackers they sometimes tell you to use in place of apples. You ever heard of that? Don't ever do that. Sorry I mentioned it. Who's the artist and who's the technician? Baker one, artist or technician? Baker one is the artist because the artist can manipulate meaningful patterns in a skillful way to achieve their desired results. Baker two, by process of elimination, is the technician. I don't care what kind of outcome it is, or I don't care how the pieces fit, or I don't care about that food's for eating. I'm just going to do what I'm, follow my recipe here, and that's what I'm supposed to do, and you know what, check the box, and now I'm going to clock out. You can eat my salty pie or not. Whatever. So the question we could ask is, what's the loving response? Forget it, I checked the box, did the outward thing, I didn't heal anyone on the Sabbath, it's fine, I'm good. Or, you know, actually, the purpose of this thing actually isn't functioning properly. Maybe I ought to readjust my patterns. And I think this is a huge piece for us teachers, because teaching is really hard. We're trying to help our students do a good thing, though we can't do it for them, which is, I think, one of the hardest things about teaching, especially in something like a discussion where it's like, I want this book to cause you to know something and to think about something. What Andrew was talking about, it's like, I got bad news. You can't cause people to know things that you don't want them, that they don't want to know. At least not in any humane fashion. Maybe you can use propaganda. But again, that's desperately dehumanizing. So what do you want? A humanizing education or a dehumanizing one? Dehumanizing has to use art, has to respect the process, it has to respect the flexibility, adaptability, variety, diversity of everyone in the room. Can't be a one-size-fits-all. There are definitely patterns, though. There are things that are very beneficial. But again, that's a fine line. We have to use our judgment to figure out what it is that is going to be helpful. Sometimes we get it wrong. Sometimes we get it right. I mean, that's the most amazing thing, is to see the light bulb go on. So the reason that interpretation is important to think about as an art is because interpreting the world is an art. I mean, you tell most people about, yeah, I teach microexegesis at this tiny school and we read Aristotle, and like, what's the point of that? What's the point of the art of interpretation? It's like, use the art of interpretation thousands of times a day. The only question is whether you're any good at it. You use the art of interpretation when you're responding to a loved one. You use it when you're buying bananas in the grocery store to see if they're ripe or not. Interpretation is unavoidable. The key piece for our students, I think, is how they're building their worldview off of the kind of interpretation they have. These questions come from Sire, The Universe Next Door, which I strongly recommend. And those questions are, what is prime reality, the really real? What is the nature of external reality, that is, the world around us? What's a human being? This is a messy one today, like the other ones. What happens to a person at death? Why is it possible to know anything at all? How do we know what's right and wrong? What's the meaning of human history? Right? Is this a progress fest toward utopia at the top? Is it something else? Is it cycles of problems that actually never leave us because humanity as such doesn't ever change? You can't believe both because they're mutually exclusive. So the thing that I would say is, put these in front of your students, if I may be so bold as to suggest it. Let them know, like, whether you articulate the questions or not, those are still the questions. And if you give them the tool of the question, then they'll not be enslaved to impoverished, simplistic, reductionistic answers. Give them the tools. Education can't save. I couldn't agree more with Davies, Amanda, Andrea, and Chris. But it can equip. And it is a long, hard climb to the top. And any equipment we can provide our students is a blessing, a great blessing. And so if you put these seven questions in front of students, make it known that examining first principles is an essential skill. They're really hard to articulate, actually. It's easy when you disagree with them, like if you said something like, man is naturally good. That's an assumption out of a whole series of governments evolve. Man is naturally good. How about something like, the future will be like the past? That's something we all assume, generally. So, give them the opportunity, if they're reading or thinking or discussing, like, what are the assumptions here? Not necessarily to just dismiss them, but let them weigh them in the context of all sorts of things and guide them while they weigh them. This is an incredible benefit. Ask them, why do you think that? Why does the author think that? On what? Help me build a compelling, rational, persuasive picture of why someone might believe this. It humanizes the other person who you might disagree with, which is incredibly important if you're going to love them. It's hard to love people if we won't see them as human. And then have a discussion about the merits and demerits of various positions. Okay. So I guess in closing, I would say that when it comes to truth and culture, when it comes to sorting out worldviews, this is an ongoing, messy process. And the way students are going to interact with it is going to be different in eighth grade than as sophomores in college. And that's okay. It's normal. But don't be afraid if they don't nail it exactly the way you're hoping they'll nail it by eighth grade. I mean, as Chris was talking about, it's sort of like, yeah, I mean, none of us has total knowledge. We're all in process with various sorts of things. So trust the process, and more importantly, trust God. Trust God that he knows what the program is, and he's going to do whatever he thinks is appropriate, and that's the only thing that should be happening from his perspective. Thank you.
That was The Independent Mind in Pursuit of Truth by Elliot Grosso. You've been listening to a recording provided by Gutenberg College. You can find more information about Gutenberg College on our website at www.gutenberg.edu. Any broadcast or retransmission of this recording without the express written permission of Gutenberg College and the conference speaker is prohibited. Thank you for listening.